The Tom Woods Show, episode 2160.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, if you've decided it's best not to have your kids educated by people who have declared war on you, then consider the self-taught Ron Paul curriculum. Instructors like me will give your kids an unfair advantage and an education you and I could only have dreamed of. But make sure you join through my link, because only there do you get my $160 worth of free bonuses. My link is ronpaulhomeschool.com. Hey folks, Tom Woods here, delighted to be joined once again by our old friend CJ Kilmer, who hosts the Dangerous History Podcast, which you can check out at dangeroushistorypodcast.com. CJ pours an enormous amount of work and research into those episodes, and he's doing a tremendous job and has been for years getting real history out there to people like you and me. He, in particular, let's see, over this past weekend, I'm talking to you in mid-July 2022. Just last weekend, I had the privilege of hearing him speak at my own event. I put on an event in Orlando, and CJ spoke on propaganda, which we're going to be talking about today. We're going to talk about a particular historical event that involved propaganda, namely British propaganda in World War I, primarily, but then also perhaps a bit of American propaganda. But I do want to mention he was speaking at a special members-only event I held for members of my School of Life program, which I launched back in February for people who are tired of whining and complaining and who actually want to build and do something. For people who feel like, let's see, they're coming for our food, for our affordable energy, for our children's minds, for our jobs. Maybe it's time we stop debating the non-aggression principle and actually do something practical to defend ourselves. How about that? How about we cooperate with each other to see what kind of world we can carve out of the ruins that these people have created? Let's see if we can pool the many, many talents we all have collectively and build something that our children will find worth living in. That's what we're trying to do over at the School of Life. So I had CJ come and talk about propaganda, because you need to be on guard against it. You need to know the tactics they use. And you can even perhaps think about why propaganda is successful and use that knowledge ethically to spread genuine knowledge. So my event in Orlando that I had over the weekend was all practical topics. It wasn't debating this little how many angels can dance on the head of a pin argument against that one. It was all practical questions. People walked away with big to-do lists in their notes. So we're reopening for a few days in early August to bring more members in, and then we're closing it up again. So get on the wait list and be part of this. TomSchoolOfLife.com. That's the website, TomSchoolOfLife.com. CJ Kilmer, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Tom. Great to be with you again. I feel like I haven't spoken to you in almost 30 hours.
Yeah, I know. We just saw each other, of course, over the weekend at my in-person event that I did for my School of Life people. And you gave such a great presentation. I would say I have been to many, many events. I don't know that I've ever seen people happier and more satisfied with how an event went than at that thing. And the speakers were all great. It was all good, practical topics. Then we closed out with comedy from Dave Smith. What more could you ask for? So it was tremendous fun. So everybody remember, TomSchoolOfLife.com. That is where the cream of the crop are to be found, the people who are tired of complaining and want to build things. So you talked about propaganda, and that is a natural topic of conversation here, because all day long we deal with propaganda. I mean, these days, even the headlines in the newspapers are propaganda. The headline half the time tells you the way you're supposed to think about something. I was just talking the other day to a reporter who's been covering these Dutch farmer protests, and you can just see the way the AP covers it. Well, Dutch farmers protest pollution caps. You think, oh, well, I like farmers, but pollution's kind of bad, so maybe the farmers are kind of... So you get no sense of what this is actually all about. So you are doing an episode, or are you in the process of doing a series on the Dangerous History Podcast on propaganda, specifically in the British case during World War I? Am I remembering that right?
Yeah, well, I've done a few standalone episodes related to propaganda recently. But yeah, I actually have studied propaganda in history since I was in graduate school. I actually took a graduate seminar on kind of 20th century propaganda, and I even wrote a big graduate school original research paper would have been a thesis, but I was doing a non-thesis MA at the time, but on British Empire propaganda in the early 20th century. And as part of that, I started to look into World War I propaganda, and pretty quickly I found out that pretty much all experts who have studied World War I propaganda agree that in terms of both the amount and kind of like the slickness, the effectiveness of propaganda during World War I, the British were definitely number one. And the United States actually was probably number two, even though the U.S. was in the war for less than two full years, which is pretty impressive. So the series I'm doing is actually going to be on World War I propaganda in the U.S. And so I decided to do the first episode, which ended up being, I just kept working on it for like literally months, and it ended up being huge. I don't have it quite finished yet. I've recorded everything. I don't have it quite all edited out yet, but it's going to be, I would guess, somewhere in the neighborhood of 4 hours total. It just kept growing because the thing was, the U.S., like I mentioned, was only officially in World War I for less than 2 years, actually only a little over a year and a half. But for close to 3 years, while the U.S. was quote-unquote neutral, but not really, the British were running a gigantic covert propaganda operation. So anyway, this is going to be like a mini-series. The first episode is just covering the British propaganda ops in the U.S. during the period of alleged American neutrality. And then the subsequent episodes are going to cover different aspects of the actual American-made propaganda after the U.S. intervention into World War I. So the way I have it kind of in my head right now is that I'm going to do an episode on the actual propaganda cranked out sort of top-down. So meaning all the different types of propaganda cranked out by the notorious Committee on Public Information that Woodrow Wilson set up very shortly after he got his declaration of war. And then I'm going to do another episode on the censorship, kind of the flip side of propaganda, right? Because you want to put out your narrative, but you also want to squash and marginalize and, when possible, silence competing voices, as we know from recent experience. So I'm going to do an episode specifically about that, the various ways in which the Committee on Public Information and other aspects of the government using the Espionage and Sedition Acts that were passed, which included clauses that were interpreted and enforced to criminalize free speech the government didn't like during the war. So I'm going to do a whole episode on that, and then I'm going to do a whole episode on what I'm calling maybe horizontal enforcement or lateral enforcement, as well as horizontal propaganda. So that episode is going to be on the various ways in which private citizens, private corporations, and private organizations also contributed to propaganda and censorship. And actually, some of the most horrific cases of thought policing in the U.S. during World War I were actually carried out not directly by the state. They were carried out by private individuals and associations and things. And then I'm also probably going to do a whole episode on the way that American academia jumped into the propaganda game in World War I. And a lot of American academia was already on board, even during the period of American neutrality. They were already, you know, pro-intervention, pro-British especially, but pro-Allied in general, and anti-German. There was only a minority of American academia that either just wanted to stay neutral, and an even smaller percentage that were actually pro-German. So academia, I've got at least one whole book just on the ways that American academia acted as propagandists for World War I. So I might do a whole episode on that because I think it's Thaddeus Russell who has said a lot in recent years, things to the effect that like, you can't find a war that America got into or started where academia wasn't a big part of it. You know, whether you're looking at the two world wars or you're looking at, you know, the Vietnam War, more recent things, you know, supposedly liberal academia are often some of the biggest war hawks around, as we can see in the way they're reacting to the whole Ukraine situation.
Yeah, so much for this myth that academics or the left wing or whatever are anti-war necessarily. You know, you find a handful who are hardcore anti-war, but at the time of World War I, as you say, honestly, it's very, very hard to find them. You know, we do have stories of disloyal professors, so-called quote-unquote disloyal professors, getting in trouble in universities. But really, Jane Addams, Randolph Bourne, not very many progressives who were not enthusiastically on board for this. Now, when you say that the British were engaged in covert propaganda operations in the U.S., We know Woodrow Wilson obviously favored the British side even before U.S. intervention. Was he aware of these efforts going on in the country?
That is a really good question that after reading just piles of books and articles and, you know, trying to look into as many of the primary sources as I can, I still can't answer that for sure.
Yeah, I didn't think so.
I suspect that he must have known at least some of what was going on. For sure, actually, the British do very similar thing, but in a way even bigger during World War II, prior to Pearl Harbor. This is run by a guy named William Stevenson, who had the codename Intrepid. And one of his top subordinates was Ian Fleming, the creator of James Bond. And supposedly the character of M in the James Bond novels was based on this guy, William Stevenson, who was an Anglo-Canadian covert operative who carried out all sorts of operations in the U.S. prior to Pearl Harbor. And in that case, for sure, we know that FDR knew what he was doing, and what he was doing, what William Stevenson and his cronies were doing in the U.S. violated U.S. law. They were doing things they shouldn't have done, intervening into American politics. FDR knew about it. In fact, in that case, J. Edgar Hoover knew about it, because of course he knew everything about everybody. And I've read that basically J. Edgar Hoover at least had half a mind to maybe go after these British operatives in the U.S. You can imagine, by the way, if FDR found out that there were German operatives carrying out propaganda operations in the U.S. before Pearl Harbor, they probably would have dealt with it very differently.
Yes.
And basically, FDR in that case ordered Hoover to stand down and look the other way and allow the British to continue operating, which when I've brought this up with my students in class in recent years, I've pointed out, like, what FDR did in allowing the British, knowingly allowing the British to operate in contravention of U.S. law covertly in the U.S., like, that far surpasses even the most outlandish, you know, accusations about Trump being an agent of the Kremlin or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, here we have a case of a president, like, actually, for sure, deliberately colluding with a foreign power in contravention of U.S. laws at the time. And then he gets placed on a pedestal as one of the greatest presidents of all time, which is really kind of interesting. So anyway, long story short, in the case of World War II, for sure, FDR knew a lot of what the British were doing and deliberately looked the other way. I can't say for sure. I haven't found like a smoking gun, you know, document or whatever for Wilson. I suspect that he knew at least some of what was going on. One thing that's very interesting and that looks kind of circumstantial to me is the head of British propaganda in the US, the guy really running it, was a British nobleman who actually was originally from Canada, who had traveled extensively in the U.S. throughout his lifetime, had even lived in the U.S. for a number of years, and so knew America very well. His name was Sir Gilbert Parker. And he was nominally, in terms of like his, you know, overt story, he was nominally some sort of employee of the U.K. government working in the U.S. And the fact that he was the head of propaganda operations, that was secret at the time. But interestingly, Sir Gilbert Parker and some of the other guys that were high up in the propaganda operation in the U.S., they pretty quickly became very friendly with Colonel House, you know, Wilson's right-hand guy at the time. And I think it was shortly after the U.S. finally intervened, Sir Gilbert Parker resigned from his job because he was basically like, mission accomplished, you know, I got the U.S. into the war. And then he went on some sort of like a vacation with Colonel House and President Wilson. So to me, you know, can I say 100% for sure that Woodrow Wilson knew all of what Gilbert Parker had been up to the last 3 years? No, but I have a hard time believing that Wilson, you know, was completely clueless.
Yeah. I mean, that's pretty darn suggestive. What was the nature of the propaganda being spread before the U.S. involvement? Was it mostly the Belgian atrocities?
That was probably one of the biggest recurring themes. And, you know, most, if not all, of the atrocity stories that they covered were either completely fabricated or, at the very least, were grossly exaggerated. That was a big thing. And one of the things that the British did, which made their propaganda so much more effective than the little amount of propaganda the Germans were trying to do at the same time in the U.S., one of the things that made them more effective was that the British propagandists were constantly looking at kind of market research and feedback as best they could, trying to gauge American opinion and figure out, you know, what of their propaganda is working and what isn't. And pretty quickly, they figured out that the atrocity stories were really, you know, resonating with Americans. Because if you think about it, you know, you've got to convince Americans, you've got to convince some Kansas farm boy that, you know, jumping into a war in Europe, thousands of miles away, they tried, it was kind of hard. They could only do so much to convince Americans that Germany was like a genuine threat in the short term to the U.S. I mean, some people kind of bought that, but that was a bit of a harder sell. But a lot of what they did for sure was the atrocity storyline and the, like, you know, someone's got to do something. Oh, aren't you a good person? Don't you want to be a humanitarian and save these, you know, poor Belgian civilians? And then another one that they kind of tried to turn into an atrocity narrative was the U-boat warfare. They tried to portray the German U-boat warfare as being more sinister than it really was. They concocted a lot of stories of, you know, German U-boats strafing and shooting at lifeboats after they sank a ship, like all these sorts of things. And what's really interesting, and something that I cover extensively in the episode, is most Americans back then and even today have no idea that it was the British who first broke the laws of warfare at sea during World War I. That they, almost immediately from the time they entered the war, they slapped a total blockade against Germany that included mining the hell out of the North Sea. And in a whole bunch of ways, the blockade they did on Germany broke pre-existing rules of naval warfare that had been worked out over the centuries. And among other things, they didn't really differentiate much between, you know, enemy and neutral merchant ships. And also, the British were trying to keep everything out of Germany, including food and medicine and things like that. And so hundreds of thousands of German civilians starved or died of, you know, related things like disease and malnourishment over the course of the war, far beyond, like orders of magnitude beyond whatever the real, you know, because yeah, for sure, civilians were killed in Belgium and in some of the occupied areas of France. There's no question that happened. It always happens in war. But, you know, when you total the number of German civilians who died due to the British blockade, it's not even close. And most Americans had no idea that that was even happening. And most Americans today, most Americans don't know much about World War I anyway. But even those who do, the starvation blockade of the British might as well not have happened. Now, it's true that the German U-boat blockade also broke pre-existing, you know, rules about warfare at sea. But the Germans didn't start doing their U-boat campaign for, 8 months to a year after the British had already been trying to starve them with an illegal blockade first. And so, yeah, the Germans also were breaking the rules, but the point is they didn't do it first, and they were doing it in retaliation after the British did it first. But because of how effective British propaganda was, the American people had no idea the truth of this. And in fact, one of the things that the British did, like right away when they went to war, which was an absolute masterstroke, literally the first British offensive operation in World War I was a propaganda move. And what it was they sent a ship, a specialized ship designed to lay and maintain underwater telegraph cables. Because back then, you know, you had telephones, but you didn't really have long distance telephone service. And so your best way of communicating over great distances, especially across oceans, was still the telegraph. And so there were telegraph lines laid across the Atlantic Ocean connecting the U.S. to, you know, a lot of the major countries in Europe. And so the very first offensive operation the British did in the whole war, literally like the morning that they declared war on Germany, they sent this ship out, and they had already planned this well ahead of time. I don't even know, you know, at least months, if not years in advance, they had done the recon. They knew exactly where the telegraph lines going from Germany to the U.S. were. And so within hours of declaring war, they sent the ship out. It destroyed the German telegraph cables that went to the U.S. And the British never let those be repaired or replaced for the duration of the war. And of course, meanwhile, they made sure all their own telegraph cables to the U.S. were, you know, always up and running. And so literally from day one, the British had what you might call narrative hegemony, because almost all information going to the United States about what was going on the ground in the Western Front had to funnel through British telegraph cables. And for sure, you know, the British government was being very selective on what they would allow to be transmitted, and they were keeping tabs on all of it. So, for example, let's say an American reporter is observing and reporting on the Western Front and wants to send a story back to their home paper that they work for that in some way either reflects badly on the Allies or reflects well on Germany. Well, probably the British aren't going to allow that to go through their telegraph cables, right? So this is a beautiful example of invisible censorship. It creates unknown unknowns because American newspapers and the American public, they have no idea that they're only getting one very carefully crafted narrative of what's going on the ground in Europe. Now, other themes aside from the atrocity stuff, the U-boat warfare, of course, the Lusitania was a big deal when that happened. And, you know, the British were happy to craft a particular narrative of that, which I get into in detail in the episode. There's a lot of things about the Lusitania that are really fishy and that don't fit with the commonly believed narrative in the US and UK. And then they made up a whole bunch of other stuff on top of it, like that the Germans were celebrating it as a holiday, which wasn't true. But other big themes in their propaganda that they were pumping into the US would be things like Germany is a uniquely evil, militant, aggressive empire, which, I mean, if you just think about it for a minute, for sure, the German regime of the time was a militaristic empire and all that. But who were their opponents? Their opponents were Britain, France, and Russia, who, guess what? They are also, in the early 20th century, militant, aggressive, expansionist empires, all three of them. So, you know, but the narrative they're pumping into the US is like, no, it's totally different somehow. And another big one that they harped on a lot was the Kaiser is this uniquely evil, sinister character, which not long after the war, lots of British leaders started publicly admitting like, yeah, actually, he's just kind of a typical, you know, run-of-the-mill European head of state of the time. You know, like, yeah,
right.
Everything you could say bad about him, you could also say about the Tsar of Russia and various leaders in Britain and France, you know. So that was another big thing. And then another one that they harped on a lot was Germany bears sole responsibility for starting the war. And, you know, that's completely ridiculous to anybody who studies where World War I really came from and how it started. But people just get that pump relentlessly into their head for 3-4 years, and competing takes on it are largely, you know, silenced or marginalized. And this, of course, lays the groundwork for how ridiculously unfair and punitive the Treaty of Versailles ended up being. And then that in turn, you know, lots of people with fancier credentials than me, but I agree with them on this, would agree that basically the single biggest factor in causing World War II, at least the European parts of World War II, the single biggest factor is for sure how ridiculously unfair the Treaty of Versailles was. Like, if you were trying to set it up so that in a few years Germany would be spoiling for revenge and whatever, you couldn't have done much better than they did at the Treaty of Versailles. So those are some of the main themes that they harped on.
Isn't it interesting that after all that propaganda, they still had to use a military draft to get enough people to do it. And they still had to have people on street corners spouting regime-approved talking points. They had to do every bit of this propaganda even to get conscripts to do it. It did not result in a massive outpouring of volunteers.
Yeah, and there's actually sort of parallel to this. I'm still working on my long, I've actually been working on it for a few years now at this point, a long, super detailed, many episode series on the life and career of Woodrow Wilson. And obviously closely related to this World War I propaganda mini-series that I'm doing as well. And on that series, I haven't yet got to where World War I breaks out and Wilson does his, you know, phony hokey-pokey dance pretending he's neutral, he's really not, and then eventually gets into the war. But when I get to when he does get the U.S. fully into the war, he actually asked for a military draft in his initial speech asking for a declaration of war. Like, he already was asking for the draft even before day one. And he also has a request in his speech that's mostly about, you know, wanting to declare war, where he requests Congress to pass laws to basically crack down on free speech and those sorts of things, like from the very beginning. And the exact line he says in the speech, he says something like, if there will be disloyalty, it shall be dealt with very harshly, something like that. That's not the exact words, but something very close to that effect. So he gets them to pass those laws, the Espionage Act in 1917, the Sedition Act in 1918, to criminalize free speech and all that stuff, free speech the government doesn't like. And then he also, like almost immediately after he gets the declaration of war, he gets an act passed for conscription, the Selective Service Act of 1917. And a few, I want to say a month or two later, he issues a proclamation on the day, he's setting the deadline for when American men of a certain age have to register for the draft. And it's this proclamation, and I have it, a copy of it somewhere, and I'm going to read a bunch of it word for word when I get to that episode in the Wilson series. But he actually says in his proclamation announcing that the draft, you know, registration deadline is approaching, he says, his words, "This is not a draft of the unwilling." He actually says that. Like, this is intense gaslighting. This is like someone punching you in the face while saying, "I am not punching you in the face." He says, "This is not a draft of the unwilling." To which my answer, if I was a military-aged male at the time, would be, "Great, then I don't have to go then. You know, if it's not a draft of the unwilling, I'm unwilling, so I guess I'll sit at home then." And he goes on to say something like, "It is selecting from the nation which has volunteered en masse." So in other words, in his, you know, progressive democracy religion, his interpretation in, you know, in Wilson's case, he might have actually believed this nonsense because he was such a believer in all this. He's basically saying by Congress declaring war, he interprets that as the entire nation has volunteered to fight, and that all the Selective Service Act is doing is just picking from among the entire nation who have all volunteered, you know, unanimously en masse in his fantasy. All the Selective Service Act is doing is simply picking from those who are, you know, best qualified to go over there and fight. I mean, it's just insane. When you hear his actual words, it's gaslighting.
I want to say a quick word about, because you were talking about Versailles, and so I want to say a quick word about the revisionist historians, particularly a guy named Sidney Fay, because he wrote a revisionist account of World War I. Now, this obviously, this was way before a lot of the documentary evidence was available to him. But in 1920, he got a revisionist article published in the American Historical Review, such that by the time you get to the 1930s, I would say maybe a majority of Americans believed the revisionist view of things, you know, that it was a much, much murkier, the origins of World War I, than simply it was the terrible Germans' fault. And then, of course, the implication of the revisionist historians was best to just stay out of these European conflicts. So that's interesting. I mean, it'd be interesting to see if we could get revisionist takes on other major episodes to become the somewhat conventional wisdom. I hope COVID goes down that road, that's for sure.
Yeah, given the fact that so many American academics were war propagandists during the war itself, it's amazing how many of them quickly at least backtracked somewhat off of that. And, you know, in the 20s and 30s, when I cover this aspect of the 20s and 30s in my classes, I always tell students the 20s and maybe even more so the 30s were really a unique time in American foreign policy discourse, because the only other time I can think of where it was relatively allowed in the mainstream to really question things in that way would be the handful of years right after Vietnam. And that didn't even last as long as sort of the hangover after World War I. So, you know, there's a lot of revisionist historiography, and, you know, some of it's written by academic historians, some of it's written by people who are more like journalists and just sort of independent researchers. Harry Elmer Barnes does a lot on this. I think even Charles Beard did as well, if I remember right. And then you get to the 30s, and in the 30s is when you have Smedley Butler sort of hitting his high point as an anti-war, anti-military industrial complex speaker and writer. And it's amazing, when you look at some of the stuff Smedley Butler was saying in the 30s after he retired, he was saying stuff so radical that the most far-out left-wing Democrat today would never say. And yet he was actually getting somewhat of a hearing in mainstream media outlets in the 30s. And then you also had the Nye Committee in the 30s, which was a committee in the U.S. Senate headed by an anti-war progressive senator named Gerald Nye. And they
talk about saying things that would not be said today, right?
Oh, I know. It's crazy. I mean, they really dug deep into the ulterior motives of the war, why the U.S. really got into the war, the various ways in which corporate America profited off the war. Really astounding. And they grilled people that I mean, J.P. Morgan Jr., the original J.P. Morgan, of course, was long dead by then, but they grilled his son, the head of the DuPont family at the time, they grilled. And I mean, good luck finding a Senate committee that'll do that today. Probably no one but Rand Paul would even be interested. But the Nye committee actually got the plug pulled on it prematurely because Gerald Nye, he was a progressive, but he was a progressive Republican from one of the Dakotas. And he was sort of like a Robert La Follette progressive. So he was good on war. He was good on civil liberties, that kind of thing. And in the 30s, when he was just digging into like the DuPonts and J.P. Morgan, most people who know the basics of American history will know, mid-30s, the Democrats not only had the White House, they had giant majorities in both houses of Congress ever since 1932. And they were fine with Nye looking into some of these corporate bigwigs, especially ones that were kind of more Republican than Democrat. But the committee got the plug pulled on it prematurely when they started to really kind of zero in on the Wilson administration itself. As soon as they started to do that, then, you know, partisan hackery kicked in and the Democrats running the Senate were like, all right, you're done, show's over. And that was that. So, you know, as much as the Nye committee dug up, which is, you know, pretty shady as it is, who knows what else they might have potentially gotten if they had been allowed to just run as long as Gerald Nye wanted to go.
Yeah. Boy, that's crazy. Anyway, CJ, I really believe you are one of the unsung members of our movement out there. And, you know, you may say that's a nice compliment, but nobody wants to be unsung. You want to be sung, right? So we're going to sing the praises of CJ Kilmer. I was just looking back in my list of episodes because you mentioned Smedley Butler. And you and I did an episode on Smedley Butler on this show nearly 6 years ago.
Holy cow.
Yeah. Can you believe that much time has gone by? It was 2016. So we go back quite a ways, and you have been just churning out great historical content over and over again. And I want people to interact with you and get to know you and your material more. So, of course, the podcast is the Dangerous History Podcast. So you can find that on all the podcatchers you use or at dangeroushistorypodcast.com. But there's one other thing you want to promote, so I want to give you a chance to do that.
Sure. And thanks for the kind words, and thanks for giving me the opportunity to kind of pitch myself and what I want to try to do to all of your listeners. And I think, you know, anybody who listens to Tom Wood's show will definitely appreciate the content I do. I do some shorter episodes. I do the occasional interview with somebody else, but I do a lot of the long solo kind of deep dive, like Dan Carlin, but with Murray Rothbard as sort of the, you know, ideological viewpoint for the most part. And here's the thing, for people who don't know about me, I've been teaching college history now for, I think, 15 years. And so that's, you know, my full-time job most of the year, other than I get a couple months off in the summer. And so I started the Dangerous History Podcast 8 years ago, almost exactly 8 years ago. It was actually in the summer of 2014. So I've been doing it that long. And I've tried to, you know, continuously improve as much as I can as I've gone along, you know, get better audio, get better at, you know, it's sort of a different sort of a way of speaking when you're doing a long solo podcast. I had to kind of get used to that too. And I really, when I started, I was already kind of, you know, a little bit dissatisfied with my day job in various ways. And that has only increased over the last 8 years. And of course, once the COVID era hit, it increased tremendously. And I want to do more Dangerous History, and I want to do other things too. I've got other projects I've had in mind that I haven't been able to do. And the problem is, I've been in kind of a catch-22. The Dangerous History Podcast has only been able to be a side hustle for me. Now, for what it is, it's been pretty successful. Like, I make some decent, you know, side money and everything like that off the Dangerous History Podcast. But I haven't yet been able to get it quite to the point where I can step away from the day job and just do not just Dangerous History Podcast, but other things, you know, content creation and so forth, independent full-time. I haven't been able to do it. And it's been a catch-22 because I know that probably the biggest reason I haven't been able to quite get to where I can leave the day job is that I haven't put out, you know, huge amounts of episodes. Sometimes I can't put out more than one episode a month.
But you put so much work into these episodes. People should understand. It's not like you and me chit-chatting. This requires no prep on my part. I just go with my existing knowledge and I talk to you. You're like Dan Carlin, I think.
Yeah, for sure. Especially the longer episodes. I mean, I hope I'm up to Dan Carlin's quality. That'd be great. But he's sort of the gold standard when it comes to long historical narratives. But yeah, I mean, definitely just in terms of depth and length, like I mentioned near the start, my episode on British propaganda in the US during World War I, probably going to run at least 4 hours. And I've been recording segments for that since May. And I was reading and researching and putting notes together for months before that. So to do this one episode, it's been, I don't even know, 6 months in the making. Now I do shorter things that don't require as much research from time to time just to fill it out. But yeah, the reason I can't make quite enough dough to leave the day job is that I can't put out more content. The reason I can't put out more content is because the day job eats up so much of my time and energy, yeah, at least when school's in session. Because, you know, I think you taught college for a while, a long time ago, right, Tom?
It's mentally exhausting. Yeah, I mean, I'm not on a roof building a house. I'm not running a race or anything, but it's mentally exhausting.
Yeah, yeah, it really is. It really is. And it eats up a lot of your time, too, because it's not just the classes you teach. You know, you're grading papers, you're answering student questions, you're dealing with bureaucratic things, paperwork, whatever. And at least in my case, I have almost an hour commute to get to work as well, each way. So when school's in session, it really puts a limitation on what I can do as far as content creation. Yeah. So I need to, like, you know, have that kind of ability to break away. And just to let people know, there were several things I was in the process of starting to get going right before COVID hit. So one of the things I was about to do before COVID hit was I was going to start a second podcast that I was going to call the Guerrilla Scholar Warrior Podcast, which is a little kind of slogan I've been using for a long time. And that one was going to be not about history at all. That was going to be about things like self-improvement and self-reliance and even things like self-defense and those sorts of things. A lot of stuff that, you know, dovetails nicely with the Tom School of Life stuff, really. And I was getting ready to launch that one in early 2020. I bought the domain. I commissioned the cover art for it. I started putting together notes for a few episodes. And I even recorded the first episode. And then COVID hit. And when COVID hit, the amount of hours I had to spend into my day job, because classes went all online for a while. And that was an insanely time-consuming and exhausting thing to deal with, all of my classes suddenly being online. And most of them were classes I had never taught online before, so I didn't have any material to use. I had to build the class as I went. And so I was making the same amount of money from the day job, but I was literally working probably twice as many hours to do it. So I basically just put the second podcast on hiatus, on suspension. I never launched it. I never published that first episode and put the podcast feed up. And then another thing I was starting to do around the end of 2019, beginning of 2020, I was starting to put together, I was calling it Dangerous History Lyceum instead of Academy, because everybody uses Academy. And I was going to start putting together audio courses, and I started to work on my first one, which I was going to call Rise of the American Empire. And I did an intro episode, and I did my first real kind of course lecture on it about how the United States got Transappalachia in the Treaty of Paris at the end of the Revolutionary War. That was where I kind of started the story. And again, I got two lectures in that done, and then COVID hit. And once COVID hit, then it was all I could do to occasionally put out a regular Dangerous History podcast episode, let alone, you know, no way I could also be doing a second podcast and be continuing to work on this course, which I was, you know, offering to people who support my show. So those are just a couple of things that I would love to get started or restarted. But again, I can't do that if I don't have the ability to step away from my day job. So what I came up with, and I'm really kicking myself and feeling like an idiot that I didn't think of this a long time ago, but what I realized just in the last few weeks or so was maybe the best way for me to be able to step away is a one-time, all-hands-on-deck crowdfunding campaign. So, because I know if I step away from the day job, not only do I lose my salary, which I don't get paid great, but, you know, it's something. And in many ways, more importantly to me, keeping me at the day job all these years, are my benefits. You know, I've got a wife and two kids, and for the last 14, 15 years, we've been getting health insurance, dental insurance, everything else like that through my job. And obviously, if I step away from that job, it's not just the you know, net salary paycheck I lose. It's all of that. And, you know, my wife has a job. She would be able to get health insurance and dental. We would be able to get it for our family through her job. But unfortunately, where she works, all that stuff costs a lot more money. So we'll take a much bigger bite out of her paycheck than it would out of mine working at the college. So that's why I finally realized, like, maybe my only chance to get out of the catch-22 of being kind of trapped in this situation is to have a one-time crowdfunding thing where I can put together kind of a little nest egg, because I know that if and when I step away from the day job, I will be able to ramp up my output on all fronts. But there's going to be a lag time of at least several months. And, you know, I can't predict for sure how long, but there's going to be a lag time between when I step away from the day job and start to ramp up my output, and then when that starts to pay me in terms of, you know, more income to make up for the fact that I will be getting benefits, you know, healthcare and stuff through my wife's job, which costs more. So anyway, that's the predicament I'm in, that I'm hoping that crowdfunding might be the solution to. And unfortunately, because I didn't think of it until, you know, about halfway through the summer, I don't have that long to make this happen if it's going to happen. You know, in order to give my job 2 weeks notice that I'm not coming back, I would have to get the crowdfunding done in about 3 weeks, to be honest with you. And, you know, I have to say, for all the complaints and problems I have with my job, most of the people I work with and most of the people who are, you know, my supervisors and whatever, they're good people. Like, I really haven't had any personal issues with any of them. So, you know, I do want to do the decent thing and give them as much notice as I possibly can if I'm not coming back for this school year. So anyway, that's the situation that I'm in, and that's what I'm hoping that people will help me out with.
All right. Well, if you'd like CJ to be able to teach way, 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 way more people than just the people who just by happenstance are sitting in his classroom, then I set up a redirect link where you can go and help him out. So that's tomwoods.com/CJ, just those two letters, CJ. So tomwoods.com/CJ. Let's see what we can do to help out one of our, as I say, one of the unsung members of this libertarian community of ours, but who's been doing an awful lot of work quietly, kind of behind the scenes. You may not see him at conferences, although you'll see him at mine. He speaks at my conference, but he's been doing great work, as you can see. You go to dangeroushistorypodcast.com, you can see for yourself that he puts in the time. He doesn't release stuff on the fly. He puts a lot of effort into it. He does that for us. So if you like and appreciate that, then let's do something for him. So tomwoods.com/CJ is the link for that. I'll have all this stuff up on the show notes page, which is tomwoods.com/2160. Well, thanks, CJ. Best of luck to you.
Thank you, Tom. I really do appreciate it.
All right, folks, let's help out our friend CJ at tomwoods.com/CJ. He's a good guy. He deserves our support. Go check him out, tomwoods.com/CJ. And of course, this is the caliber of person you're going to find inside my School of Life program. So you're going to want to be part of that too. So check that out. Sign up to be notified when we reopen at tomschooloflife.com. I'll see y'all tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.